So Michelle was appointed the Deputy Governor at the RBA on the 2nd of April this year. She's a Deputy Chair of the Reserve Bank Board and Deputy Chair of the Payments System Board and a member of Chief Executive Women. Prior to her current role, Michelle was the Assistant Governor of Financial Systems. She's held a variety of senior management positions in the bank. She was Assistant Governor for Business Services, Assistant Governor for Currency, Advisor for the Currency Group, and Head of Payments Policy Department. Following Michelle's presentation, there is going to be an opportunity for you to ask some questions. We've only got a short time, but please think through some of those questions if you have something. And also a call out to our virtual attendees. If you've got some questions, remember to pop them into the chat. And without further ado, please welcome Michelle to the stage.
Wow, that's sort of weird. thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today, to address the conference. It looks like you're having a great time. I know AFIA's membership is very broad, brings together everyone from traditional ADIs all the way through to fintechs and technology sort of companies in the finance sector. But I think you all have a couple of things in common. One, you're all influenced by the economy and interest rates. And actually these days, developments in the payment system are critical probably to most of your business as well. And the Reserve Bank is in fact a key player in both of these areas. So what I'm going to do today is cover off two topics. First of all, I'm going to talk about how the bank and the board make decisions on monetary policy. And what I'm doing is I'm going to update a speech that Glenn Stevens, the Governor, made in 2009, where he set out some of the bank's internal processes that we go through for making these decisions. But then I'm also going to highlight some of the innovations we've made since then, particularly in terms of data that we now use for monitoring the economy. And these innovations in data, if you like, these are because of advances in technology and our digital lives that we're all now living in Australia and around the world. And then the second part of my remarks, I'll talk a little bit about the payments system. But first of all, to monetary policy. So the Reserve Bank's obligations with respect to monetary policy are set out in the Reserve Bank Act 1959, and in short, they are stability of the currency, full employment, and the welfare of the people of Australia. Now, in practice, we interpret this to mean that the bank should control inflation while taking account of the impact on employment and financial stability. So the framework we use for controlling inflation was set out by the Governor in a recent speech he gave. We aim to have consumer price inflation average between 2 and 3% over time. But how do we actually go about determining every month the best stance of monetary policy in order to meet this goal? Well, the first step is very extensive monitoring and analysis of data on inflation, the domestic and international economies, financial markets, and financing conditions. So I'll start with the monitoring and analysis. There's effectively two parts to our ongoing analysis. The first is understanding current economic situation and trends. And for this, we use many, many data sources. Central to our analysis of domestic economic activity is the data produced by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Now, the ABS, it produces high quality data on all aspects of the Australian economy: income, production, the labour market, trade, investment, consumption, inflation, and so on, all of these things. And this provides us with a really good view of where the economy is at and also some of the trends that are going on. But there's also a large variety of data that are produced by other public agencies and the private sector. And we use all of these other indicators to supplement the official data. So, for example, we obtain data on loan commitments from the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, and we also receive data from them that allows us to measure credit and deposits in the economy. There's surveys of business and consumer sentiment, and job advertisements. These are also very important partial indicators that we follow closely. Now, over recent years, there's been an increasing availability of very timely information, and that's supplemented our traditional data. Many of these data sources are artefacts of the online and digital lives we all now lead, and they come from both the public and the private sector. And it turns out that many of these are valuable for understanding what is going on in the economy in a fairly timely way and fairly high frequency in some cases. During the pandemic in particular, we used these data in a much more structured way for our analysis. I thought I had some graphs, actually. Did I have some graphs? Yeah, there they are. Okay. Great. Someone's on the ball. So a good example of this was the use of timely information on household spending and activity. So like many policymakers around the world, the staff at the bank used this information to get a better real-time assessment of household consumption. And that was really critical, as you could imagine, to our assessment of the economy during the pandemic. So the bank staff used this partial information to develop a monthly consumption tracker, which is what you can see on the graph. It's an estimate of aggregate household consumption that's available well ahead of the ABS national accounts. Now, some of the data that goes into this are card transactions, restaurant bookings, flight departures, Medicare benefits, and mobility data that Google and others have. And combining all these data allows us to get a more up-to-date reading on what households are spending their money on. And it actually does a pretty good job. And you can see from graph one the performance of the consumption tracker over the past couple of years. And you can see that it doesn't do a bad job, that the final dot is the actual, but it does a fairly good job month to month of figuring out where we actually were going to end up. Now, because there's a need for forecasts for some components of consumption, as well as a need for judgment on what is price and what is quantity in spending, the estimates can move around month to month. But you can see broadly, it's given us a pretty good estimate of the actual change in household consumption a few months ahead of the national accounts. Now, another area we have timely information is the labour market and wages. And this is graph two. So while we've had business surveys such as NAB and AIG surveys for some time, during the pandemic, the ABS started publishing data on payrolls, which uses ATO data from Single Touch Payroll. And Commonwealth Bank now produces a monthly wage indicator from its customer base. And SEEK has recently started producing an advertised salary index based on jobs on their platform. And then lastly, accounting software company Xero uses data from its large number of small business customers to compile several monthly business indicator indices. And all of these give us a bit of an idea, again, much more timely, of wages and labour market trends. The Australian Bureau of Statistics has in fact been using many of these new data sources to improve its statistics and provide additional timely information. And the most recent one, of course, is the monthly Consumer Price Index, which is another innovation. So it's not as comprehensive as the quarterly CPI, but it gives us a much more timely reading on the inflation pulse. You can see it's a bit more volatile, but generally the trends are pretty similar. Again, technology has been a great opportunity here. The scanning technology used by supermarkets, for example, provides the ABS with a very timely and comprehensive read on grocery prices. And I actually expect that this monthly indicator will only improve as our digital lives provide more data and we continue to refine our techniques for making the best use of it. Now, the final element of the bank's monitoring analysis is our business and community liaison program. This program's actually been running for more than 20 years, actually. However, it's come to prominence lately because we've been a bit more explicit about how it's shaping our thinking about wages in particular. So bank staff across the country are continually meeting with businesses, government agencies and community groups to better understand what is happening right now and what's likely to happen in the future, according to these groups. And what we do is we gather this information in a systemic and structured way, a systematic and structured way, and that allows us to generate useful summaries on current economic conditions. And we've been increasingly reporting insights from the program in the statement on monetary policy, and a regular summary of liaison messages will in fact be included in the November statement on monetary policy, and that will be a regular thing. Now, that's sort of the first part. So there's a lot of data and analysis. The second part is the outlook. Given what we know about where we are and the current economic conditions, what does this imply for the future? Now, this is important because while we know monetary policy has long and variable lags, we need to form a view about how interest rate moves now might impact the economy and inflation in the future. And this isn't easy, obviously. Now, our forecasting process is an amalgam of a number of things. First, we need to understand, as I said, where the economy currently is, its direction of travel, and any emerging trends. And that's what I've just talked about, the sorts of things we look at there. From here, what we do is we use a mix of formal models and judgment. So no single model can provide us with all the answers. So we draw on a variety of models to make our forecasts. For most of the key macroeconomic variables, such as consumption, inflation, wages, or the unemployment rate, we have formal econometric models. We also have more comprehensive econometric models, including our full system economic model, which is known as MARTIN, after Martin Place, I think. And they're used to underpin our forecasts to develop alternative scenarios and perform sensitivity analysis on what might happen if we change our assumptions or conditions change. And then all this analysis and forecasting ultimately finds its way to the board. But before we get there, it actually goes through quite a rigorous internal process of testing and challenge. So, as you probably all know, the board meets on the first Tuesday of every month except January, because we're having a holiday then. And this frequency of meetings actually is quite unusual internationally, and I'm going to come back to this point a little bit later. So the monthly board cycle follows a process that's been refined over many years, and it starts 2 weeks prior to the board with monthly reviews, and these are prepared by our staff in our various policy areas. And these reviews basically document what we know about domestic and international economic conditions and also financial markets. It gives us the key messages from our liaison program, and all of this information will ultimately form the backbone of what is going to go to the board. And from here, there's a sequence of internal meetings at which the current economic conditions and the outlook are discussed, and views on what should happen with monetary policy are sought from all the staff. It starts with small groups of staff in economic group and financial markets group. The staff debate amongst themselves what they think is going on, what they think should happen with policy. And then economic group and financial markets group hold group-wide meetings, and they're usually attended by myself and the governor. And at these meetings, the staff present their updates in their various areas of responsibility, and then we follow this with a discussion of monetary policy. What do people think should happen? The lead-off speakers are sometimes scheduled to make cases for different policy options, and all staff are encouraged to offer their views on the recommendation to the board. So, for example, in recent months, these discussions have included views on the size and timing of interest rate increases. And in the past couple of years, it's also included views on the use of what we term unconventional monetary policy tools, their size, and when it would be appropriate to adjust or cease them. Then 1 week prior to the board meeting, we hold a thing called the Policy Discussion Group, and that's chaired by the Governor, and it's attended by many of the senior executives of the bank. And each month there's two papers at least discussed, the economic conditions paper and the financial markets paper. And we start with that information in those papers. What's the information telling us about the state of the economy? What about financing conditions? How should we interpret recent data? And then following that, we open the floor for views on the recommendations to the board. And I'd have to say there's typically very open discussion at this point. There's never a shortage of views, I can tell you that, and there's often notable differences of opinion. And the Governor, he encourages open debate and he actively calls for contrary views. There's also often discussion about the communications challenges associated with particular policy options. How do we communicate? How do we make sure that people understand why we're making the decisions we're making? So following this meeting, the monetary policy paper, including a recommendation to the board, is finalised by the Assistant Governor for Economic, and that has input from the governors and the assistant governors of financial markets and financial system and the head of economic analysis department. So from this point, 9 a.m, first Tuesday of the month, except January, the board members meet and they get a variety of materials, including the economic conditions and financial markets paper, and they get the monetary policy paper with the recommendation. There's often other papers as well. So twice a year we have a financial stability paper, which is presented by the Assistant Governor Financial System. And we actually discuss the financial stability paper at the October meeting. And most of what we discussed in that actually was published in our financial stability review a couple of weeks ago. Then four times a year, the board receives a paper on the economic outlook as well, which summarises the staff's forecasts and views on risks and uncertainties associated with the outlook. And that paper ultimately forms the basis of the outlook chapter in the Statement on Monetary Policy. Finally, there's regular special papers that cover topics that often they're important and they're a medium-term nature, but examples include the neutral real interest rate, various aspects of unconventional monetary policy, inequality in monetary policy, and the implications of climate change, all much more medium-term issues, but important for the board to understand. So at the board meeting itself, we have the Assistant Governors for Economic Group and Financial Markets Group deliver presentations that cover the key themes. And the board and then we discuss, and the board members are very active in the discussion. They ask a lot of questions, not only to understand issues, but also to challenge the interpretation of staff. The members bring their own knowledge of economics, finance, and also their wider commercial experiences to bear. Now, at the most recent meeting in October, the process that I've described culminated in a decision to increase the cash rate by 0.25 percentage points, or 25 basis points, however you like to think about these things. That took the cash rate to 2.6%. Now, there was no doubt that a further increase in interest rates was warranted. Inflation in Australia is too high at the moment, and it's expected to rise further. While a lot of this can be explained by global factors, such as supply chain disruptions and energy prices, there is an important element of strong domestic demand here as well. Indeed, the labour market is very tight. Unemployment is as low as it's been in around 50 years. And this is starting to put upward pressure on wages. For all these reasons, interest rates need to rise to ensure that inflation returns to the 2 to 3% band over time and that inflationary expectations remain anchored at that level. But there was an active discussion, both internally at the board meeting, about the appropriate size of the increase. On the one hand, as I said, inflation is high, the labour market's strong, and that indicates that interest rates need to rise further. On the other hand, there's already been a substantial rise in interest rates since May, and along with house prices, that's beginning to put pressure on household budget, along with price rises, that's beginning to put pressure on household budgets. So how household spending will respond to this is a little uncertain. The other thing that's happened is the international economic environment has deteriorated quite sharply. So for these reasons, the board thought a smaller increase in October was warranted, while it just took stock of developments in consumption wages and the international economy. Some commentators have contrasted the board's decision to raise rates by 25 basis points with those of overseas central banks that have been increasing interest rates in larger increments. In part, this reflects our different economic particular economic circumstances. But it's also relevant that the board meets more frequently than most of our peer central banks. The Reserve Bank Board is making monetary policy decisions 11 times a year. So it's discussing the evidence on the economy, has more flexibility on the size and timing of rate increases. This is a particular advantage in uncertain times, as it allows more frequent evaluation of the evidence and recalibration if necessary. It also means that if we increase interest rates at every meeting, we can potentially move much faster than overseas central banks. Or alternatively, we can achieve a similar rise in interest rates with smaller increments. And this is what, in fact, you see on this graph. The incremental change in the policy rate at recent meetings has been smaller than some other major central banks, but our policy rate trajectory has been as steep or steeper than other central banks. The board expects to increase interest rates further over coming months, but the pace and timing will be determined by the economic data. Some of the factors that the board will be monitoring include the global economy, household spending, and wage and price setting behaviour. You shouldn't be in any doubt, though, that the board is determined to do what is necessary to return inflation to target. Now, I see I'm sort of running up against a bit of time, but I would like to spend a little bit of time on payments, because I suspect some of you are involved in payments one way or the other. Used to be a boring plumbing of the economy, and it's now at the forefront of innovation. The community has become come to value quick, cheap and seamless payment services, and technology is increasingly providing this. So over the past couple of, in the late 1990s, payments was all about cash, cheques and direct entry. There was credit cards and FPOS were starting to become important, and banks were at the centre of the payment system, providing services to merchants and consumers. I'd have to say the payments ecosystem couldn't look more different today. Cards are the most commonly used payment instrument, but now we tap and go instead of clacking and dipping. They're used online as well as face-to-face. And in many cases now, we don't even use physical cards, but digital representations of cards on a variety of devices. We've got a fast payment system that allows person-to-person payments in a matter of seconds. And customers can pay for goods and services using buy now, pay later services, effectively digitising instalment, credit and lay-bys. Furthermore, payments is no longer simply the domain of banks. We have non-bank acquirers for card transactions, payment gateways, payment facilitators, wallet providers, buy now, pay later firms, cross-border payment specialists. And now we have stable coins on the horizon. So this has led to a few key priorities, and in the interest of time, I'm just going to focus on three. First of all, we're working with Treasury to implement the reforms to the payment systems regulatory framework that were recommended in the review of the Australian payment system in 2021. And there's a few key elements to this. First, there's amendment to legislation to ensure that the bank's regulatory perimeter is broad enough to capture the new payment systems and the payment system participants. And second, there's a number of new regulatory regimes to be developed that are intended to assist non-banks to participate more directly in the payment system. And a critical priority here is the regulatory regime for payment service providers, along with common access requirements for payment systems. So non-banks have consistently noted that they're at a competitive disadvantage because they're often unable to gain direct access to payment systems. They have to connect through a direct participant, typically a bank. The argument of payment system operators has generally been along the lines of, well, participants bring risk to the system, they need to be supervised to join. So this makes it difficult for payment service providers that are not banks and do not need to be banks for the services they provide. A licence that is proportionate to the risks that payment service providers bring to the system, coupled with some common access requirements, would make it easier for non-bank payment service providers to participate directly in payment systems if they choose. Now, part of this regime will include a simplified licensing process for stored value facilities. So these payment service providers typically have fairly simple business models. They receive money from customers, which these customers then use to make payments using cards or mobile wallets. Some of these providers allow international payments. At the moment, these entities face a rather convoluted supervisory regime involving ASIC, the bank and APRA. But it's clear that this is not tenable, and reform has been on the agenda for a number of years, but it's becoming increasingly important. And the rise of stablecoins, payment stablecoins in particular, which look very much like stored value facilities, has given further impetus to this. The second key priority is supporting the shift to digital payments. There's a number of strands to this work, but I'd just highlight developments in the new payments platform. The bank is a great supporter of the NPP, and there's been a number of things like PayID, which has, I think, been a great initiative. Pay2 is also a great initiative, and that'll give consumers more control over their payment authorities. This has been an issue as long as I have been in the payments area. It's a consistent complaint from customers that attempting to move banks is too difficult because direct debit authorities are just painful to move. Pay2 is hopefully going to provide opportunities for many innovative companies to provide service to their customers that will utilise this. And it's disappointing it's not up and running yet, but we are expecting the major banks to do this by April 2023 so we can realise its full potential. Now, the third and final thing is research into central bank digital currencies. So we've been somewhat sceptical to this point about the case for retail CBDCs, so like a digital banknote. We've been more open-minded about wholesale central bank digital currencies being used as part of real-time settlement. We are interested, though, in what potential use cases might be, and so we've engaged through with the Digital Finance Cooperative Research Centre, and we've launching a digital AUD pilot program. There's recently been a white paper issued on this issue, and we're asking businesses to come forward with business proposals. It's quite a big step because it's not just a proof of concept. This pilot program is going to involve a real claim on the Reserve Bank. So our focus is not on the technology, but it's on the use cases. What are the business cases? And so, as I said, we're inviting firms to come forward with their innovative ideas to test our digital AUD. And I have to say, so far, there's been quite a bit of interest in this. And it's come from some traditional financial institutions, but also a lot of fintechs and new entrants to the industry. So I hope this brief discussion of the Reserve Bank's monetary policy process has given you some insight into the board's monthly interest rate decision. And I also hope that you've got a bit of a flavour about the way we're using new data sets and others are using new data sets to monitor economic conditions in a more timely way. As for the payment system, things are changing fast, and an important part of the bank's role is to keep up with developments, and our strategic priorities reflect this. So thank you for your attention.
Questions? Now for some questions. So there's two microphones. So if you just get Alex and Elle's attention, make sure you wait for the microphone because of our virtual attendees. We do need them to hear the question as well. Di.
Thank you, Michelle. That's a timely discussion about how the Reserve thinks about things. And it's not just data, it's human judgment as well. So I'm keen to hear how you're using data and technology and how you might be thinking about or are using behavioural economics as well as the economics.
Yes, I think there is an element of thinking about behavioural economics in everything we do. I think one of the important behavioural sort of issues at the moment we're grappling with, which is very important, is what are consumers going to do with the large payment buffers, large savings buffers they built up during the... This is actually quite an important issue because they could go one way or the other. They might choose to continue to save it all, or they might choose to spend it. They might look at their household budgets and say, you know what, I've got all this saving, I'm going to run it down. Which way they go is going to be quite important for the way the economy develops, I think. So this is one of those uncertainties where behavioural economics might help you, but it's very uncertain. So it's just another reminder that economics isn't driven by very, very precise models. Behaviour is really important here. And I think how, as I say, this is going to be one of the key behavioural responses that is going to colour what happens in the future.
Any more questions? This is a great opportunity while we've got Michelle on stage.
Hi, Michelle. With the banks in Europe and the US continue to increase interest rates, even if we have a shallower recession and we get inflation under control here, will we not need to follow their lead in order to preserve the value of the Australian dollar?
Yeah, it's something that we watch, obviously. But we're not only driven by that. I'd make a couple of observations there. First is that everyone's focused on the US dollar, Australian dollar exchange rate. At least a good part of that is due to general strength in the US dollar itself. So everyone is declining against the US dollar. If you look at us on a trade-weighted basis, we've declined a bit, but nowhere near as much as... And that's probably the more important thing for inflation in Australia. So, yes, we will have to watch that, but it's also true that we need to be cognizant of our own economic conditions. And I think we still feel, and I know the Governor's used the term narrow path on a number of occasions, we still feel that there is a path for us here where we can get inflation down, not go into recession, preserve most of the gains in employment that we've had over this period, which has been an absolutely outstanding for employment. So, yes, we'll need to watch the exchange rate, but it's also true, I think, we need to keep a very close eye on our own domestic economic conditions.
Thank you. We've got time probably for one more. Is there any...
Hello. Thanks very much. Marty Gray from Block here. One of the things I think a lot of us in the room have seen is when you talked about changing payments, that mobile devices have, you know, grown up light speed even in the space of a couple of years, and to a certain extent the device manufacturers or operating systems are somewhat the payment rails of the 21st century, some have said. How are you and the team thinking about this going forward as you think about the future of the payment system?
I think at the moment we feel, as I said, that there's quite a number of participants in the payment system who seem to technically are outside the regulatory net. So our feeling is that they do need to be brought back within the regulatory net. And our focus here is on competition and efficiency. And if there are certain parts of the payment system that are not subject to competitive pressure, then we want to be looking at them closely and figuring out whether or not there are things we need to do to make sure that competitive pressure is brought to bear. Because everyone taking a clip of the payment on the way through, it quickly becomes pretty expensive. So, and competition is the way to make sure that doesn't happen. So it's a fairly broad answer, but that's what we're thinking about.
Adam, is yours quick?
House prices. So obviously you talked about the build-up of household savings being a driver in inflation. The other one is the wealth effect from increases in property prices. Hmm. There's a lot of commentary around at the moment about the fixed rate cliff that's potentially coming. Hmm. To what extent does that come into the thinking?
It certainly comes into the thinking, and as I said, it's interesting to think about how people will behave because of those buffers. We know the people that have got the buffers are the people often with the big mortgages too, so that they've been using low interest rates to build up. From a financial stability perspective, it's not going to be an issue for the banks. The banks are well covered. That's not to say that there aren't some households going to be coming under pressure. I think house prices, I would say house prices is interesting because a couple of years ago everyone was complaining they're going up. Now everyone's complaining that they're coming down. So we really can't win on this. Even so, they have started to come down. They're still 20% above where they were. They're still... So, yes, wealth effect is important. That's going to be important for thinking about the behavioural impacts. The buffers people have built up on their mortgages is going to be important. And I think... we do have to watch that there is a vulnerable edge on this and just making sure that those households are not... They're going to be hit, but at the moment the advantage they have is that they probably have equity in their home. They're not going to be underwater, which helps in terms of stability and also their ability to get out of their particular situation. So there's some of the things I think that we're thinking about.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Please join me in thanking Michelle.